But I remember exactly when this Crash Test Dummy song came out. It was 1993. I remember it so vividly because I happened to be in grade 8 at the time. How many of you remember being in grade 8? That is, I don't care who you are, that ain't no pretty time for anybody. That is a tough, tough year. And I remember this song came out, and I loved it. It describes this public embarrassment of these three kids. And I remember it hit me at the right time or the wrong time. It was so poignant to me because it was grade 8, and I had, like, the worst case of acne ever. Just covered, right? We all did, right? And I remember just, it's difficult when your face is what embarrasses you. And it was just... Cody, it's just a little echoey up here for me. I don't know if it is for everyone else. But I had it bad, and I remember in gym class, I was so embarrassed to change because I had it on my shoulders as well, right? So, you know, get your shirt off, put your gym shirt on real quick. I don't want anyone to see, and it was so bad. I remember I had to go on Accutane. Accutane? Okay. There we go. You know what I'm talking about. This stuff is radioactive. Like, it will get rid of your acne, it will also get rid of your face. It is just, it dries you up so much that your skin just like falls off all the time. So it's like you go to school and you either have acne or you show up and your skin's falling off all the time. And so you have to put moisturizer on every morning. So either go to school looking like you covered your face in butter or your skin falls off. And this is no easy time in grade 8 to be dealing with that sort of thing. I was just so embarrassing. I mean, a time of life for me felt like I was living in a constant state of embarrassment. And ever since then, I feel like my life has been a whole string of embarrassing events to endure. It's tough being embarrassed. I feel embarrassed almost all the time. Just last weekend, I had another bout of public embarrassment. Chris and I were out with the kindergarten friends again. Yeah, you remember how well that went last time. And we were out with them again, and we're out. The one guy, he's a lawyer, and he had just come from work, so he just looked so sexy, so suave. He, you know, he had lost his tie, you know, so he just had this nice suit, and it was, you know, just was looking all casual. He just looked like a million bucks, like straight out of Suits, basically, is what I'm saying. In general, what I'm trying to communicate to you is that we basically are twins, he and I. We sort of have the same look. And I ordered a glass of wine, and the waitress came over and dumped, you know, got one of those little glasses, you know, dumped it in my wine glass, handed to me, fair enough. He then proceeded to order a glass of wine, and the waitress came over and poured a little in and said, would you like to make sure it's satisfactory to you? And, yes. It's good, I'll have it. She poured the rest in and walked away, and I just sat there like, what? Like, how come he gets the you want to taste before you drink treatment? I just got it dumped in. So now I'm annoyed. Every time she comes over, I'm sort of feigning my wine existence. So she comes to refill the water. I'm like, oh, man, I really, really picking up saffron in this wine. It's quite unctuous, really, in my wine terms. And I'm annoyed at this point, so I'm like, no, I was only wanting one glass of wine. Now I'm like, I got to order another. I got to figure out if this was an intentional slight or an accident. So I ordered another glass of wine. And she came over, and she just dumped it in my old cup and said, oh, I just assume you don't need another new glass. Then he proceeded to order another glass of wine. And you can imagine what happened? Same thing. Comes with a new glass, takes the old one away, new glass, pours a little. Would you like to take a taste beforehand? I'm sitting there like, unbelievable. Like, do I look that ridiculous? And of course, Kristen's like, yes, it's very clear you have no clue about wine at all. But I just felt so embarrassed. I could see him smirking at me like, well, if you had dressed up for the occasion, Brad, maybe you would have got the taste of the wine before treatment. But it just... It's embarrassing to think it's that painfully obvious that you're sitting across the table from someone who clearly knows something about wine and you don't. I hate being publicly embarrassed. And you know, it's interesting to me because, you know, Eliza picked up on this with her story too. There's something bizarre about being embarrassed that's different than being sad and angry. Like, I can think back on memories where I was sad or angry, and I can sort of think about them like neutrally. Like, I can think about them without getting sad or angry again. But embarrassing moments, when I recall the worst embarrassing moments from my past, like, I get embarrassed all over again, right? Like, you still feel that feeling. And so to be embarrassed is like this nearly unbearable feeling, but it's something I think we can all relate to. It's a universal fear. Everyone fears being embarrassed, and for good reason. You see, embarrassment whispers to us an excruciating message that none of us want to hear. And the thing is this, I'm convinced the message that it whispers to us contains truth. And we know it contains truth, and that scares us. Because here's what I think embarrassment whispers to us. Oh no, people will think I'm thoughtless or lazy or greedy or stupid or foolish or inadequate or weak. And this is why we fear embarrassment so much, because it jars our self-image in a way that few other things do, because none of us want to be seen negatively. And so our fear of embarrassment is really all about how other people see us and think about us. And the embarrassing moments in our lives, they give us these, they're chilling to us because we realize that those around us see us at our weakest and most inadequate. It's a terrifying feeling. It evokes like a powerful fear in us. It's so strong, it's like stepping down on a tin can, like your pride is just crushed in embarrassing moments. And we think, my goodness, oh no, I'm going to be seen as weak and inadequate. And this is hard for us because in life we have a self-preservation instinct that's very powerful. I recently read the book Alone by Brett Archibald. Fascinating book. I got to tell you, if you're looking for a great book to read during Lent leading up to Easter, you want to reflect on death a little, this is a great book to read. The story is fascinating. Brett Archibald, he and 9 friends, they chartered a boat in the middle of nowhere, Indonesia, to go surfing. And so they set off one night with their captain, and they're in the middle of kind of these stormy seas, and everyone had gotten food poisoning. So everyone on board is throwing up. And Brett Archibald, he makes his way up to the deck, and he's so sick from food poisoning that he blacks out and falls overboard. And so he wakes up in the sea, still sick, food poisoning, and realizes nobody on the boat realizes he's fallen overboard. And so it would be 12 hours before anyone even realized he was missing. In total, he treaded water for 28 hours. And the story is his reflection of hour by hour his thought process. And there's a whole lot of death in this story, just contemplating his mortality and just the constant urge, keep swimming, they'll come and get you, they'll come and get you. And 28 hours, it's like absolutely insane to me that someone can tread water after they've already had food poisoning and have been sick by that. It's a fascinating book, but it details this grappling with death and trying desperately, hold on, try to survive. And a story like this, it reminds me of how powerful our self-preservation instinct is. But our self-preservation instinct is larger than just physical preservation, right? Our ego and the image we project of ourselves into the world also has a tremendous self-preservation instinct. Our ego, our image has this self-preservation instinct. We will keep swimming. It refuses to die. It will fight tooth and nail to maintain our image and how we present ourselves to other people. And what the terror of embarrassment is this, moments of embarrassment rob us of our well-honed, well-protected images. It takes the veil away. You know, it's said there's actually 3 us's. There's the person we think we are and present to others. There's the person other people think we are and see, and then there's who we really are. So there's the Brad that exists in my head and that I project out to others, but there's the Brad that you see and notice, which can be very different than what's going on in my head, and then there's who I actually am, and the gulf between those three is sometimes massive. And what our self-preservation instinct does is it tries to ensure that other people think about us in the way we want to present ourselves and project ourselves. And you know, one of the things I've considered, I think as we grow older, one of the things we realize the older we get is just how little control we have in the world. We have so little control over life, right? We can't control the environment. We can't control the economy. We have no power over government. We have no power over world affairs. And increasingly, as we age and mature, we realize, my goodness, I have so little control, so little power over the world. And so one of the last vestiges of control we think we have is this: I can control the way people see me. I can control how I present myself to others, how I'm thought of, how I'm remembered. And what embarrassing moments do is they totally remove that veil. They take away that presentation. They expose us for who we are, or at the very least, for who we can be at times. And it scares us, right? Nothing scares us more, I think, than the reality that our embarrassing moments are whispering to us that maybe what they reveal about us is true. That we are weak and inadequate and foolish. Little thought experiment here. I think I've done this before a couple of years ago. I think it's helpful though. I want you to imagine it's a little dark. Imagine you're on your deathbed. You don't have much longer to live, and in walks someone close to you who is going to give the eulogy at your funeral, and they say to you, I want to read my eulogy to you before you pass. And you think, that's good, I'd like to hear it. So what's the one word you want to hear repeated throughout that eulogy about yourself? What's the one word you need to hear? And for the idealists here, yes, we want to hear love, right? That we were loved. But I would submit something deeper to you. There's a word you want to hear even deeper than that, and I would submit the word you want to hear in your eulogy is this: great. Great. What do I mean by that? Well, imagine you're at my funeral, one of my kids walks up to deliver the eulogy and says something like this: hey everyone, welcome, sorry we're gathering under such circumstances, but anyway, I'd like to tell you about my father, Brad. Let's see, well, in terms of being a father, my dad, I loved him, but he was pretty average. Truth be told, quite inadequate for the task. Some as you know, he was also a pastor, pretty normal, nothing special. A lot of times he didn't have a clue what he was doing. It hurt the church, actually, a bit, but anyway, he meant well. In terms of a husband, he was pretty average to Kristen. I think he tried hard, but of course there was the time when he left her alone on her birthday and went to the Leafs game with his brothers. So he's also a foolish idiot as well. I didn't do that this week, I swear. Anyway, thanks for coming. Like to tell you, overall, my dad was often foolish, weak, and inadequate, but we loved him. Like, can you imagine someone reading that to you and be like, okay, we're going to have to do some editing here because I sound like a complete loser. Oh. What do you want to hear? Here's what I want to hear. I want my child to come up and say, he was a great dad, the greatest. There was no greater father than my dad. Pastor, my goodness, he was great. When he spoke, it moved mountains. He was a great husband. I'm told he was also a great lover. He made a huge difference in the world. Our world is richer for his presence. He was great. He was one of the wisest men I knew. He was great. I mean, honestly, that's what we want to hear. We want to be great at something. The only problem, of course, is not everyone can be great. If everyone is great, well, then nobody's great. To be great means to rise above others, to be better at others than something. And so I think our desire in life is to present ourselves in a way that we're significant, that we're great, that we're making our mark on our world. But to do that, here's the one thing that you can't be. You can't be average. You can't be ordinary. You can't be good enough. You can't be normal. And you certainly can't be weak or inadequate. And yet we are. And that terrifies us. And the reason we so fear being embarrassed is because those moments when we're embarrassed, they remind us of that truth. They put our ordinariness right in our face. Say, this is who you are. And for many of us, we'll do anything to avoid that truth. No, don't put my foolishness, my inadequacy, my weakness in my face. A fight to keep our self-preservation instinct alive. I want to show you a list of names on the screen here now and ask, you know, take a look at these names, ask how many of them are familiar to you. My guess is that the first one probably is, but maybe the second, Judas Maccabees, because he had something to do with the Jewish festival of Hanukkah, right? But by and large, my guess is that you probably don't recognize too many of these other names. And who these people are, they were all would-be messiahs. Each of them gained in some sort of capacity a following in Israel. All of them claimed to be the Messiah in some sort of capacity. And what is interesting to me is that there's one prominent difference between Jesus and all these other would-be messiahs. One key difference. All of these people led a movement, a revolt, and all of them, with the exception of Jesus, died trying to make their movement succeed. You might say, well, Jesus died too. Yeah, but the difference to me is this. All the others died fighting. All of them died fighting, trying to ensure the success of their movement. But Jesus, when you look at his life, well, you could almost say he just kind of gave up. He dies willingly. And this is where I find the story of Jesus both peculiar and strange. The problem is this, of course. We know the way the rest of Jesus' story unfolds, so I think we sort of miss the drama involved in this story. Jesus' career, it starts out with a bang, right? Like, he's got thousands of followers, people listening to his podcasts, his sermons. He's, you know, got a massive social media. He's huge. He's huge. And, you know, it's interesting to think about it. If he wanted, could he have made a run at Rome? He might have had a good chance at least freeing Israel, gaining independence from Rome, but something changes during his ministry. Jesus starts saying unpopular things. His followers start leaving him. They're taking off in droves. By any reasonable measure, if you immerse yourself in the drama of the story, he goes from success to failure very quickly. And then beyond that, he starts talking about how he has to go to Jerusalem, and his followers are like, you're crazy, man. I mean, just don't do that. You're going to get yourself killed. If you go to Jerusalem, your movement, this whole thing is done. It's for naught. You're going to be a failure. You're going to be just another name in the list. Would-be messiahs who are ordinary, average, nothing special, inadequate for the task, just another name on the list of people forgotten to history. Don't go there. Of course, he does. He goes there. And as he heads to Jerusalem, a sequence of events plays out. It's remarkable to me. And the night before his arrest and trial, we find him in the Garden of Gethsemane, and I love this scene because it's blatantly obvious to me that Jesus is scared. He's scared. He's terrified of what lays ahead of him. He talks of being overwhelmed. One of the verses, he talks about being overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. He's so scared and afraid, he might die from fear alone. He wrestles in the garden. Is there not another way? And so he's wrestling with fear, and I'm sure he's wrestling through those responses we talked about last week. Should he flee? Should he fight? Should he freeze, try to hide? Should he try to appease the authorities somehow? I mean, there's no question Jesus is terrified in this moment. And I think his fear was beyond just that of being scared of physical pain and death. I think there's also a great fear here of being embarrassed. Because he knows he's going to look like a loser. failure. In fact, we see that on the cross, right? The people mocking him. You could save everyone else. You can't save yourself. He must have a... He knows this is coming. And so he's wrestling not just with death, but this wrestle of, my goodness, this is going to be embarrassing. Losing any form of success I had, my movement, my legacy, my entire life, it's going to all seem like it's coming to an end in this embarrassing way. But in the end, I think what happens through this wrestle is, as Jesus wrestles through this, he's convicted. He needs to lay down his life. And he's convinced that he needs to set aside his self-preservation instinct. And obviously, he does this on a very physical level. But I believe there's something deeper going on there for us too. His desire to survive is sort of succeeded by, he's going to lay down his desire to control the narrative around who he is and how people see him. And there's two passages that speak so well of this. In John, this is before he heads to Jerusalem, but Jesus says, the reason my Father loves me is that I lay down my life only to take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. I have authority to lay it down and an authority to take it up again. This command I receive from my Father. And I love this verse here, the sequence is a verse, because it poses a question to me. Jesus has the authority to lay down his life, his self-preservation instinct. So do we have that authority? Jesus lays down this desire to preserve himself. It's something we can do too. And then he's standing before Pilate, and I love this scene. Pilate doesn't know what to do with him. He's hanging this death verdict over Jesus. Pilate said to Jesus, do you realize I have power either to free you or to crucify you? And Jesus answered, you would have no power over me if it were not given to you from above. I love what Jesus does here. It's very subversive and empowering at the same time. Reminds Pilate of this truth. It's this. You have no power over me because the thing you threaten me with is the very thing I'm willing to give up. The only way you have power over me, Pilate, is if what you wanted from me was something I wasn't willing to give. You're threatening to take my life away, but that's no longer a threat if I willingly give it up. And I find this interesting in terms of embarrassment, because he gives up his self-preservation instinct. In doing so, he heads into the humiliation of all. And what he essentially does, in my mind, is this, is he beats embarrassment to the punch. Embarrassment, you want to expose me as weak and inadequate, but I will rob you of that power by going there willingly. And I think what Jesus says in this to his followers, to Pilate, is you can take my life, my success, my meaning, my dignity. You can't take those from me because I've already given them up. I've already surrendered it. And I think, again, what Jesus does is he beats embarrassment to the punch. If you lay down your self-preservation instinct, then when something threatens that, it has no power over you. And I've got to tell you, I've been leaning into this a little bit lately, and I found it incredibly liberating. I mean, the truth is, I want to be the greatest dad in the world, for instance, but I'm not. Love playing hide and seek with my kids. They know the rules of the game, right? Like, okay, you're going to hide and I'll come and scare you and whatever. And so, you know, when they know that, there's a certain element of, okay, those are the rules of the game. But just a couple weeks ago, I was upstairs in my room, and I could hear Huxley say to Kristen, I got to go get something. I forgot it in your room. And I had this idea. I'm going to scare the crap out of him. I don't know why. But I hid behind my bed, and he came in innocently enough, and I just, dah! And the poor kid, he froze and then, God, and started crying. And then he started hitting me. I'm like, you're an awful dad. I'm like, oh, geez, what am I doing? And I'm like, why did I do that? I'm awful. Like, that was a weird impulse. I know, let's scare them. Weird. And, you know, there are times in life, in relationships, you almost feel like sorry isn't enough, right? Like, I'm like, oh, geez, I'll cover therapy for this later. But sometimes you just need to call it like it is. I'm a fool. I'm so inadequate for the task of parenting. And that's not an excuse in my mind to do it poorly, but it's just like, man, I'm weak. I'm thoughtless. I'm an idiot. I'm inadequate. And I'm sorry, but I'm human and I do stupid things. Or with Nexus, I've been thinking about this lately. Man, I cling to the self-preservation project with Nexus. Man, I cling to it with you all, with friends outside of Nexus. People, how's Nexus going? Good, 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 you know, good, good, good. It's always good. Things are rosy. In my mind, it's like, why not beat embarrassment to the punch, right? Instead of waiting to be humbled by embarrassment, why not just own it already? Like, yeah, you know, I'm not great at dealing with conflict. And I kind of suck at leading. And sometimes people ask me for advice and I kind of scratch my head like, I don't have a clue. Like, why are you even asking me? And I'm horrible with remembering names. Half of you, I don't even know who you are. Like, I just horrible with... And like, that's like the one basic thing every pastor should do. And I'm just like, I'm so inadequate. I'm so weak. I've got so many blind spots and I do the stupidest things. It's like, why? Why try to hide that? As I've been thinking about this, you know, when we cling to our self-preservation instincts, it means that we're trying to beat embarrassment at its own game. I can control the narrative around who I am and who people think I am, but the whisper of embarrassment is always this: it's only a matter of time. And if you insist on clinging to your life and how you think others see you, eventually it's going to be taken from you. And Jesus' response is so telling to me. You have no power over me when I willingly lay my self-preservation instinct down. So it is with us, the fear we have of weakness, of being embarrassed, of being inadequate, of being ordinary, it's like it has no power over us if we simply give up clinging to the idea that we are strong, that I'm well put together, that I'm adequate for any task you throw at me, and that I'm simply great enough to handle challenges. If we simply lay that down, we beat embarrassment to the punch, rob it of its power. And so in those embarrassing moments when we look like fools, it's like, yeah, I am a fool. Okay. Those moments of embarrassment when we look and feel weak and inadequate, the only way it has power is if you're consistently presenting yourself as strong and adequate. And so you beat it to the punch if you're simply willing to confess, I'm weak. I'm inadequate. My wonderful friend and mentor who I've never met, Ronald Rollheiser, he has a little mantra. I love it. It's this: fear not, you are inadequate. And I've been traveling with Ronald Rollheiser for 20 years now. He feels like an old friend to me. I continue, he's one of those guys, I keep going back to his reading because he moves me in a way, and I love this little saying of his. I keep coming back to it. I find mostly in those times when I feel overwhelmed by my own inadequacy, because I think there's deceptive depth in this little saying. I mean, I think there's some real meaningful consolation in it. Whether you're a parent or a teacher or a pastor or an advocate for justice, or just a friend to someone in need. I mean, there are going to be countless times in life where you're going to be forced to come face to face with your own inadequacy. And it happens. And I think in moments like that, it's important to remember we're not God. I'm not God. You're not God. We're inadequate. God alone is adequate. God will always be more of a parent, a teacher, a pastor, a friend, an advocate for justice than we will ever be. And I know it's sort of, I say this and it's like, man, this sounds so intuitively obvious, and yet to me it's so obvious that it's not clear to us, because what happens to us is we so often worry and we get angry and we get overextended and we think ourselves way too important. And so it's worth remembering and reminding ourselves, fear not, you're inadequate. And that's okay. God is adequate. We are but human instruments. Unlike God, we're not adequate to the task. To be human is to be inadequate. I think knowing this, reminding ourselves of this, it should give us some consolation during those moments when, you know, we find ourselves embarrassed by our own limitations, or at the very least, we think we should be doing better in life, or think we should be doing more than we are. I mean, over my time in ministry, one of the weirdest things to me that I've noticed is this, is people have more of a problem forgiving themselves than they do receiving forgiveness from others, or the idea that God forgives them. I think so many people struggle with forgiving themselves. Made a mistake in the past. And sometimes it happens so quickly, and you just harbor that for years. It's like it's okay to forgive yourself. Fear not, you are inadequate. And you know, of course, it doesn't mean that we don't try to grow and learn and mature and develop and get better. Of course not. But when you can accept this, you beat embarrassment to the punch. Fear not. You're weak. You're foolish. You're inadequate. I like how Ronald Rollheiser sums it up, because he says that if you really take this mantra to heart, it can bring you to prayer in a powerful way. He says this, simply put, if someone does not pray in some way, he or she is forever falling into either depression or into infantile grandiosity. Either there's a lack of connection to God, or there's an over-identification with God. Both have negative effects. So, Dia, if we're not connecting with God in prayer, we end up being weary, lacking energy in life. But if we're not really connecting truthfully in prayer with God, we can also develop this grandiosity that the world rests on our shoulders, that we're these would-be messiahs. It's interesting. I read the book a couple months ago about Waco, about David Koresh, from one of the survivors that survived the whole ordeal in the 90s, the Branch Davidians, where the FBI went in and took them out. And there's a new TV show called Waco as well. It explores the life and community of the Branch Davidians in Waco, Texas. And wow, this is just amazing stuff to me. And I got to be careful, because I know myself. I get obsessed with stuff. So I'm this close to going to Waco, Texas, because I want to see it for myself. But it's such a fascinating story. And, you know, side note, I'm getting more a bit about the gun control debate, because when you have a story like this in your mind that your government might come in and kill you at any time, well, that might do something to the national psyche. But this story is crazy of David Koresh. And how he got away with this. This is just a side note. At one point, because he's a cult leader, this is what cult leaders do, right? He tells the men, sex is distracting us. We must all become celibate except me. I'm going to take on the burden of sex in our community, not for fun, but so you can all concentrate on spiritual things. And they're like, okay, all right. So he's sleeping with everyone. It's just like, unbelievable. But you get this real sense when you look at his life, when you read about him, that there was just this grandiosity in life. Like, he had right at the end this idea that God had chosen him. He was the one instrument to reveal, apparently, the seven scrolls in Revelation. And until that task was finished, they could not leave the compound. It ended in disaster. But this idea, like, he was just so connected to God. Everything rested on his shoulders. And it's an extreme story, of course, but I think how often that plays into us and is the root of our anxiety and worry and concern. We feel like the world, everything rests on our shoulders. It's all on us. I think we need to hear those words more often. Fear not, you are inadequate. It's not all on you. It's an egotistical thing to think, posture to have. And so we need prayer to connect us with God, to keep us from despair and anxiety and exhaustion. We also need prayer to help us disassociate from God, to remind us God alone is adequate, that to be human is to be inadequate and weak. And there's a consolation and a freedom in that. Because by accepting our inadequacy, it allows us to lay down our self-preservation instinct and beat embarrassment to the punch. You can't expose me as foolish embarrassment if I already own it. You can't expose me as weak, embarrassment, if I already own it. You can't expose me as inadequate, embarrassment, if I already own that. And so this morning, fear not, Nexus, you are inadequate. And to accept the truth of that is to be healthily humbled. It's to beat embarrassment to the punch, while at the same time it's to be encouraged and reminded we're not God. We've never asked to be. And when we're overly discouraged in life, I think it's because we've forgotten that truth, that it doesn't all rest with us. And when we're overly proud or tied to our ego and our own success, our self-image, I think it's for the same reason. So again, this morning, fear not, you're inadequate.